Number 10.
We hit double digits.
Number 10. Hayesod Ha'asiri. Let's see if we remember them. What's 1 through 9? After all of this, we have to at least know what they are. Not necessarily have to remember all of the different sources and nuances, but let's at least test that we remember what they are. And the easiest way to remember them, by the way, is by groups. Because that's one of the things that I've tried to do, is group them. So we're going to group them.
Hashem is the creator.
Creator.
Hashem is one.
One.
He has no body.
Incorporeality.
Timeless.
Eternal.
Above his aura.
Prohibition of idolatry.
Noah.
Good. Moshe. Always remember, they go together. Right? Idolatry leads to prophecy, and vice versa. Moshe. Prophecy, Moshe.
Torah.
Shebichlav and Toshua. Petom and Hashemayim, essentially.
No replacement.
And no replacement. Good. Excellent.
Maybe an iPad?
Yeah. Wrong jacket, sorry. They're upstairs. After shiur, if you really want, I'll go upstairs, I'll get you along. All right. So, Hayesod Ha'asiri, number 10. Shehu Yitale Yodea Ma'ase B'nei Adam V'lo Izniham. That he, God, knows the deeds of man and has not abandoned them. V'lo Chedat Ha'omer Azav Hashem Et Haaretz. And not like those who say that God has abandoned the earth. This was a response to a major theory in theology and in philosophy. It became very popular in the Enlightenment period of time with a group known as the Deists, who talked about the great watchmaker theory, as they called it. Right? The theory that God as creator is like a watchmaker of a giant watch. Makes it, sets it, perfects it, leaves it, and then has nothing to do with it. And therefore, God, in his infinite wisdom, can create the world, but he can't be engaged in an understanding of the world. Cannot be aware of the deeds of man. The argument to it, which in the Middle Ages was very common, in fact, and my apologies only that I had one additional source on here that somehow got missed in the translation from my notes to the source page, but there is a whole section of the introduction to the Kuzari. Remember that? Talked about the Kuzari beginning of the year? So Rabbi Yehuda Levi in his Kuzari, when he presents various different philosophical worldviews, presents Christianity, he presents Islam, and then he presents the philosopher before he presents Judaism. And the in the Middle Ages, that was not uncommon because philosophy was considered a religious worldview. Study of philosophy was essentially the study of religion. Today we would call it theology. In the Middle Ages, it was called philosophy. So in his description of the theology of the philosopher, he presents this notion that God created the world, but then cannot be aware of anything that transpires in the world. Cannot be aware of our deeds in any way.
He cannot. Cannot. Why can't he? Can do anything.
So the argument. Well, that's the famous argument about can God create a rock that he can't lift?
But that's the Venn diagram that has no intersection.
Right. So that's the same issue here. The argument is that he cannot know the deeds of man. This is obviously not the Rambam's argument, but this is the philosopher's argument. And the reason for it is. Well, free will actually is the philosophers didn't address the issue of free will. The Rambam will. This is really the focus of the discussion on God's knowledge versus free will, predeterminism, which we will get to. But for the philosopher, and I'm sorry that I didn't have the quote from the Kuzari for you because you'd see it. It was really, it's very powerful. It's one paragraph. But the argument of the philosopher is that God cannot know the deeds of man. What's the logic behind it?
He wouldn't tolerate the evil that exists?
He no. is infinite, and we're so finite that there isn't any way that we could impact the infinite, or we could...
Close. Getting closer. It is a philosophical argument. It's not a theological or rational or good versus evil type of argument. It's a argument that cuts to the nature of God. The deists claim, or the philosophers of the Middle Ages claim, that if God is in fact infinite and perfect and unchanging, there can be no relationship between God and human beings because man is constantly changing. It's the changing that's the issue. It's the fact that I will behave tomorrow differently than I behaved yesterday, that I am unpredictable. And therefore, God would have to respond, and in responding, it would be there'd have to be change. There'd have to be change his mind, response to good, response to evil. There would have to be give and take. That would bring God into a world that was constantly changing, and in a certain definitional sense, that means that God would be changing, developing, responding, or becoming aware of things that he wasn't aware of before. It's actually the flip side of the argument about man having free will. Right? It's the flip side of the argument that says since man is ever-changing and has free will, then clearly God cannot be aware of the deeds of man because that would mean that God is changing. Right? The flip side is that if God is aware of the deeds of man, how does man have free will? It's the other half of that question. And therefore, the argument is that God could not be aware of man because the nature of God as being infinite and unchanging and perfect would, by definition, make it impossible for me to have any kind of interaction with God.
But at the end of Bresha's, when...
Well, clearly Bresha doesn't subscribe to such a theory.
No, but when he brings the flood, it actually says, you know, God was kind of, you're dealing with a huge if.
You're assuming that these deists and philosophers believe in the story of the flood and believe in the story of Bereshit. They don't. Oh. They could not. Because the story of the flood is a classic example of and predicated on
judgment from Hashem.
God being aware and then judging. Right. It's two stages. Right? Aware and judgment are two different things. Aware is principle 10, judgment is principle 11. And the Rambam splits them. An interesting exercise. Why does the Rambam split them? But he does, and we'll try to address the question of why they're different. But there's no question that if you subscribe to the theory that God cannot be aware of the deeds of man, there can be no story of the flood, there can be no story of the destruction of Sodom and Gomorrah, there can be no story of Abraham, nothing at all, Adam and Eve, nothing, it doesn't start. The Torah starts with the premise, chapter 2 starts with the premise that there's an interaction and a relationship between God and man. Chapter 1 is a story of creation. Chapter 2 is a story of interaction. If I subscribe to the theory of the watchmaker theory, then the only chapter of the Bible I can accept is chapter 1. Anything else beyond that flies in the face of this principle.
Why would they accept the God to begin with? Why not just assume this just appeared? Well, why do you have to have a God?
Well, then? In truth, today's equivalent sector of society, I think, would argue the scientific, Darwinian, purist, the world just happened theory. But don't forget that that doesn't exist in the Middle Ages. There is no such thing as secularism in the Middle Ages. Secularism, which is a worldview that does not allow for God, or that created a constructed worldview without God, is introduced into the lexicon of society in the Middle Ages. In the Enlightenment. Prior to the Enlightenment, secularism doesn't exist. So your only cultural force philosophically is one religious worldview or another. But you can be a heretic, and you can be this, because you can believe in that, you can believe in this, but ultimately the notion of a completely secular scientific world view of the world doesn't begin until science takes that leap in the 18th century. So, yeah, today I think the watchmaker theorists of the Middle Ages would be today's purist scientists who don't believe in creation. But so what they've done is they jump from number one, and in violation of principle number 10, they say, well, God created the world, but he abandoned it and has no relationship with it. So the Rambam, to counter that argument, presents principle number 10, which is a double principle. There's two issues here. Number one, Yodea Maase Bnei Adam. Number one is awareness. That by in and of itself is a philosophical statement, that God is aware of us, that we can enter into some kind of relationship with God. And if you go back to our understanding of principle from the very beginning, principle number one, is we argued, in the Rambam's view, we argued that, in fact, the very act of creation is entering into a relationship with us. And so the assumption is that it's a reciprocal relationship. Whereas the philosophers who argue that God created the world would not see it as a relational act, but simply as creation and then move on. The second piece is v'lohiz nicham. And not only is God aware, but that he has not abandoned, he's engaged. So the first deals with the philosophical idea that God is aware of our actions, that we make a difference. If I do the mitzvah, if I don't do a mitzvah, it's going to make a difference because God is going to be aware of what I've done. The second notion is v'lohiz nicham, that he hasn't abandoned the world, meaning that there are consequences. And that what I do is not only is God aware of it, but that he cares about what I do. Those are two different issues. I can split them. I could argue that God could be aware of man's deeds, but have no interaction with them, and it doesn't really matter. It doesn't make a difference to God. What the Rambam is arguing is exactly the opposite, that not only is he aware, but lo yiz nicham doesn't abandon, he's engaged, he cares, he wants to know, and he wants to be involved. So those are the principles, those are the two halves of this idea. And not like those who said, even if God created the world, he has since abandoned. Ela kamo she'amar, gedol ha'etza ve'rav ha'aliliya she'enecha pikuchot al kol darchei b'nei adam. Great is your counsel and great is the deeds of God, whose eyes are open on all of the ways of man. Verse that clearly speaks about God being aware of the deeds of man. Similarly, in the story of the flood, God Sodom and Gomorrah, God saw that there was great evil upon the earth. God saw that the evil of Sodom was great. These ideas, these events, clearly indicate. Not that you need psukim from the Torah to prove this point, because I think it's self-explanatory in every pasuk in the Torah. But nonetheless, the Rambam quotes a couple of examples where clearly you see this idea that God is aware, that he cares, that he knows. Not only that he's aware, but that he knows that which is unknowable by others. In other words, what God knows is even that which is in secret, not just because he's aware of the deeds of human society as a whole, but that he knows the innermost chamber, innermost secrets of the and intimacy of every human heart. So here in the Mefarshim, they quote a number of psukim that to express this idea. I'm not sure you need specific psukim. I think the idea is so self-explanatory from the perspective of the psukim of Tanakh. The whole notion of reward and punishment is based on an assumption of relationship. The notion of the brit is based on the assumption of a relationship. The very first declaration to Abraham was, Ani elecha l'Elokim, I will be for you a God, which is a relationship. The story of Adam and Chav in Gan Eden is the story of consequence for actions. God is aware that man sinned. God is aware and he punishes. There's engagement there. So from the first, well, I should say the second chapter of Chumash until the end of Tanakh, clearly this is a theme that runs through the entire picture. It's also a theme, specifically a focused theme, of one of the Chagim of the year. There's one entire Chag, one entire day, dedicated to the celebration of just this concept. Namely,
Yom Kippur.
Rosh
Hashanah. Yom Kippur is the next principle. So the Rambam does something fascinating. He splits awareness and reward and punishment. Why, we will have to talk about. And we will at the very end, after I've done all 13, I have a couple of classes where I do a summary of the structure and the relationship between all of them. But but Yom Kippur is all about reward and punishment, consequences. That's number 11. Rosh Hashanah is all about Malchus. Malchus is kingship. Kingship is?
It's a relationship.
Relationship. Again. Kingship is awareness. God is king, God is judge. And what the Rambam here is saying is that God is king and he is judge. And therefore what we do is recorded in God's book, so to speak. So when on Rosh Hashanah we speak about Sifrei Chaim v'Sifrei Meisim, we speak about the books of judgment, we speak about God sitting in judgment, we talk about Atah Zocher Maaseh Olam, the bracha of Zichronot, the entire middle bracha of the Musaf Tefillah of the Amidah, specifically is an address to this issue that the Rambam has raised, that God is aware. So we say, Atah Zocher Maaseh Olam, you remember the deeds of man. You know, you are aware. Nothing escapes you. Kol Yitzurei Kedem, Lefanecha Niglu Kol Ta'alamot, all the hidden things are revealed before you. V'hamon Nistarot, Shemi Breshit, and all of the hidden things from creation. Nothing escapes your sight. And if you, this bracha, I put it on the source page, although we're not going to go through it, but it's a beautiful, beautiful tefillah. Have you ever read it through? You ever sat down and actually just contemplate what it says? The bracha, the tefillah of Zichronos on Rosh Hashanah? A little bit off topic, but it's so powerful. It's worthwhile doing before. It's worthwhile before Rosh Hashanah to sit down with the Machzor and read through the Tfilot, and if need be with the translation, and just try to understand what they say. We go through Rosh Hashanah and Kippur too quickly to really appreciate the beauty of the Tfilot. It's one of the most magnificent, powerful Jewish poetry ever written. And this bracha is no different. You remember all that is created. Every creation is not forgotten before thee. Everything is revealed and known before you, God. Who sees and who looks from one end of the generations to the other end. For you bring the law of remembrance for the judgment of every living thing. So that many deeds should be remembered, and a multitude of creations without number. And then it goes into the notion of judgment over each nation and over each people and of each person, what that judgment will be. And again, Rosh Hashanah being a day of judgment, that's it's interconnected. But the theme, just of knowledge. You know, you remember, you're engaged. That we take for granted because it's so much part of our assumption. But for philosophers, it wasn't anything to take for granted at all. And for the Rambam, you can't talk about the Aleph Beis of Judaism if you don't first establish the idea that God, despite his infinitism, despite his greatness, despite his grandeur, despite his unchangeable nature, God is aware and he cares. That's the principle. He's aware and he cares. Yodea maaseh bnei adam v'lo iznicha. Both halves of the picture. aware, and cares.
I think my question is that it's just as difficult to comprehend and it's easy for us to question and understand as is the, we always hear the discussion of the question about free will. How can we have free will if God is ruling the world? This is equally unclear. It's equally, we all have questions about this.
The same question on the other side.
Right.
That question about knowledge and free will come to me. I haven't ignored it. It's the last piece that I want to get to because I'm not sure we're going to do justice in one class, but clearly this is the centerpiece of that philosophical question. Man has free will. If God knows what we're going to do, how does man have free will? The flip side is, if man has free will, how is God aware? Or how does God become aware? Does that not reflect a changing nature of God? That's the other thing. Okay, you know what? Let's do that. Let's focus a little bit on that issue at this point, since if you look at I was going to do a little bit of a digression on the notion of divine providence, of this idea that God is engaged, that he hasn't abandoned the world, and therefore he's directing the world, that he's involved in the world, that he provides. We say in the Davening, Mechakel Chaim Bechesed, he gives sustenance with kindness. He opens up his hands and he provides the sustenance for every living thing. The notion that God provides an active involvement in our daily lives. It's not just even a national involvement, but it's actually a daily involvement. That idea is so powerful that it leads to Gemara in Brachos to say that if one says Ashrei three times a day, one is guaranteed a chelek in Olam Haba. Now, there's a whole myriad of statements in which Chazal make where if you do this, you're guaranteed a share in the world to come. None of them should be understood as a kind of shortcut panacea guarantee into heaven, and that's it. You don't have to work for your bread. I see them more as a kind of focused energy. This is very important. And in order to show you how important it is, Chazal, in kind of exaggerated language, talk about it being more important than anything else. But the notion that we say Ashrei three times a day, Ashrei is a parak in Tehillim. Why would Ashrei stand out more than anything else? So here the Gemara says for two reasons. Number one, it's alphabetically written. It's an acrostic, and it kind of combines all the letters of the alphabet together. And of course, the second one being that it contains the key phrase. That phrase, says the Gemara in Brachos. You actually have it on the source page, right below the Bracha and Musaf. Amar Rabbi Elazar, Amar Rabbi Avina, Kol Ha'omer Tilal David, which is what we call Ashrei, V'chol Yom Shalosh, actually Pa'amim, the pay is missing, Muftach Lo Shehu Ben Olam Haba. Somebody says Ashrei three times, guaranteed share in the world to come. Why? If it's got Aleph Beis, Ashrei Tmi Mederach, chapter 119, has Aleph Beis 9, 8 times each letter. So that's got more Aleph Beis in it. Says the Gemara, Mishum De'itbe Poteach Et Yadach. It has this phrase. And this phrase, in a sense, is the core of what it's all about. It's all about relationship. It's all about involvement of God in our lives, personally, emotionally, historically, nationally, in every dimension. And so this phrase, this one phrase that encapsulates the whole essence of the theology of Judaism, that God has created the world in order to enter a relationship with us, provides for us, and we acknowledge and provide and thank and serve him in a relationship. But then, of course, the Rambam was not immune to the philosophical question that is that David, you mentioned before. And so let's spend a little bit of time and talk about this question. On the face of it, the deists and the medieval philosophers have a point. God is infinite. God is perfect. God is unchanging. How does he become aware of my deeds? My deeds are constantly changing. And to be aware of man's deeds means to be changing along with man. Mankind, humankind. Don't mean to be gender biased, but... So the Rambam raises this question in two places. One in Hilchot Yesodei HaTorah, and the other in Hilchot Tshuva. So we'll take a look and see if we can do both of them, and we'll go through as much as we can. You look like you're about to ask a question.
Yes. I don't think it's necessary for God to change simply because we're changing.
David disagrees. Is it necessary for God to change simply because we are changing? On the face of it, I would say it has to.
Why?
Because if God is aware of something, of me and what I do, I haven't done anything yet. So he's aware of what I've done in the past, but I haven't done what I'm going to do in the future. So he can't be aware of that yet. So he's lacking awareness.
But awareness and change are two different notions.
When you're talking about God, I'm not sure that they are two different notions.
But if you have the concept of time, going back to the timeless issue, we're a segment. So God's time is way out there. We're just a little segment.
That's a very hard concept to get my head around. We're going to have to come back to it, because at the end of the day, it's the only answer I have to this question that I can actually live with. So we're going to come back to it. But philosophers have been challenged with this question for generations. So I don't think it's a complete answer. I think it's a partial answer. But it at least it allows me to go to sleep at night.
I mean, you can make a different argument in one sense, that you can know something's going to happen and not have somebody's choice change. I mean, this is a total nahabdo, but suppose you're at a poker table or a craps table and you know you've got loaded dice and there are people who are going to play the game. They assume it's honest dice, and when you throw them, you know they're going to bet, and yet you know you're going to win. So you know what choices they're probably going to make, but you know the outcome anyway, but they're still going to do the gambling. I mean, it's a big difference, but I can know, I mean, in a little realm, something's going to happen.
But are you going to punish them for losing?
I'm not going to punish them, but I know what they're going to do. I know they're going to bet.
I'll tell you what the difference is. The fact that you know what they're going to do doesn't force them to do it.
But God's not forcing
them. Wait. Agreed?
Okay. No, absolutely.
Doesn't force them. They could change their mind.
Absolutely.
But if God knows what they're going to do, it's because they will do it. There's no options. God's not guessing. He's not conjecturing. He's knowing facts. It's even worse than that. God's knowledge forces them to do it. Because God's knowledge creates reality.
Well, then there really is no choice. Then there is no free.
Now we're
I assumed you were going to say there was free choice. It's just that God knows
what
you're going to
choose.
Now we
are in trouble. What did I just do? Oh, man.
Made it even tougher.
I made it even tougher, right? Oh, wow. Okay, let's see what the Rambam says.
So Avram had no choice but to...
Let's see what the Rambam says. Hold it, let's see. Rambam, Hilchot Yesodei HaTorah, Perek Bet, Halachat Tet and Yud. First, the Rambam lays down the ground rules. Ground rule number one. Kol hanimtzaim chutz min haborei, mitzura rishana ad yutosh hakatan, everything that exists, from the greatest in the first creations to the smallest gnat in the heartland of the world, everything created by virtue of God's truth. Let's go back to principle number one, creation. Umakir gdulato v'tifarto v'amitato v'yodea hakol v'en davar nela mimenu. And because it only exists by virtue of God's essence, God, it's the principle that we called principle of continuous creation. God didn't just create once, continuously supports the creation. It exists only because God wills it to exist. If God would cease to exist, it would cease to exist. There's a correlation between God's existence as the force that gives power and truth to the existence of the world, and the moment God is aware of himself, therefore, he becomes aware of everything that's created, because everything created is part of God.
Okay, so...
Therefore is yet. Hold the therefores. So far, I haven't said anything that will challenge us yet. Other than he's aware. Fine, he's aware. Now, halachayur. This is where life gets fun. HaKadosh Baruch Hu makirem mito v'yodea ota kemo shehi. God knows his essence and his truth as it is. Ve'eino yodea b'deya shehi chutz mimenu kemo she'anu yodim. God's knowledge is not like our knowledge. See, we are confused because we're using borrowed terms. We talk about man's knowledge. We talk about God's knowledge. We talk about we knowing. We talk about God knowing. But it's a borrowed term. And it's a borrowed term that makes no sense. Why? She'en anu v'da'atenu echad. Because we are not at one with our knowledge. We exist and we acquire knowledge. Linearly, sequentially, we are unaware of something, we learn it, we become aware of something. So we acquire knowledge, which means that that knowledge is separate from us. It's a separate item. It's something out there that I, through my five senses, have to begin to internalize, become aware of. But I become aware of it, I learn about it, it's separate from me. Aval ha-borayit barach, when it comes to God, hu v'da'ato v'chayav echad. God and his essence and his existence and his knowledge is all one thing. You can't separate them. You can't say God becomes aware of something sequentially or linearly, because that would create change or time. And God is outside of the realm of time, so clearly he can't establish, can't develop knowledge sequentially. So it all has to be part of God, as if to say, all at one given moment. The whole past, present, future, everything, the whole gamut. It's all part of God's essence. You can't separate God's knowledge from the essence of his being.
So he has to have knowledge of all these things since the beginning of time.
Again, you're assuming there's a timeline. We're going sequentially, and he knows it all. But there's no timeline. It's just, it's part of God's essence. It's part of God's being. Then what we call knowledge is part of God's being. He hasn't made the problem any easier yet. It's only made it harder. It's part of God. God and his knowledge is one. Okay. Then he says, "Il male haya chay b'chayim v'yodea b'deya chutz menu." If God was one thing and his knowledge was something he acquired, hayu sham elohot harbe, then there would be multiple gods. Hu v'chayav dato. Then he and his knowledge would be separate, distinct. And since each is infinite and each is God, so you have more than one God. And suddenly we're into violation of principle number 5, or principle number 2. Ve'ena devar ken, ele echad mikol tzad, mikol pina, u'b'chol derech yichud. Go back to principle number 2. Everything is one. God is one. His knowledge is, it's all part of the same God. Nimtzet ata umer, Hu hay, now listen to this phrase. This is a beautiful phrase and a key phrase. Hu hayodea, hu hayadua, v'hu hadeya atzma, hakol echad. He is the knower. He is the known. He is the knowledge. It's all one. Now you understand why I said that God's knowledge creates reality? Because God's knowledge is part of his essence. God creates reality by his very being. And now I have a problem. One second. And then he finishes and he says, V'davar zeh ein koach befeh le'omro v'lo ba'ozen lishmo v'lo b'lev ha'adam l'hakiro abuyo. This concept is too difficult for the human mind and finite, limited mind to comprehend. You can say it, you can figure it out mathematically, but to understand what it means, the finite mind can't begin to get its hand around. Yeah.
If I understand what he's saying, that because God knows what's going to happen, since he's creating everything constantly, he's creating the situation, so you're forced to do what you're going to do. But then you go back to the Torah where Hashem says, I will harden Pharaoh's heart. That, well, of course he did, because he made everything
happen. So that's the free will question.
So why would he have to go out of his
way? So that's the free will. Why does everybody else have free will? That's his free will question. And that's what he says in Hilchos Teshuva. In other words, once you've established this, he's made it worse. Once you establish the idea that God doesn't acquire knowledge, God is knowledge, and knowledge is part of God, then you really have an enormous question with the issue of free will. Because his knowledge is creating reality. And that's why when the Rambam writes in Chot Shuvah, he formulates this question, he does so in a way which is almost unanswerable. And here's where this is one of the most famous passages in the Rambam in his entire writing. Shema Tomar. V'alo Kadosh Baruch Hu yodea kol ma sheye v'kodem sheye yada sheze yeye tzadik v'rasha v'lo yada. Lest you say, remember he's talking about the laws of tshuva. And he predicates the fact that tshuva is based on the concept of free will. So he says, how can man have free will? God knows everything that's going to be. And if he knows everything that's going to be, he knows that this person is going to be righteous, and knows that this person is going to be wicked. So how can you punish one and reward the other? How can you hold them accountable, which is at the core of what tshuva is all about, if their actions are predetermined by God's knowledge? Im yodeh shehu yeh tzadik, if shashalo yeh tzadik. If God knows that this person is going to be righteous, he can't be anything other than righteous, because that knowledge is part of the reality of the world. And if it's possible that man still has free will, and if God could know that you're going to be righteous, but in fact you'll be wicked, like your example of the pool table, then God's knowledge is unclear. It's not absolute. And clearly that can't be either. Then God would be imperfect, finite. Clear question? Good question? That's the free will versus God's knowledge question. The Rambam asks it, articulates it, strengthens it, clarifies it, and then he doesn't answer. And he says, Da. Know that the answer to this question is wider than the sea and deeper than the earth. There are many great principles and great philosophical ideas that are built around and predicated on this idea. But you should simply know and trust me on this one. Namely, I've already explained to you in Perek Bet, which I just read you now. For the Rambam, it's a whole different section of his book. But he says, God doesn't acquire knowledge sequentially as something which is outside of himself, as we do. In our case, our knowledge and ourselves are two different things. That's where the person can remain and lose his knowledge. It is possible for us to lose our knowledge. Correct? We can lose our minds and still be alive. God can't, because his knowledge and his essence are one. Elohu yitalashmo dato echad. God and his knowledge are one. Ve'ein dato shel adam yichola la'asig davar zeh albuyo. And man can't possibly begin to fathom how this works. U'kashem she'ein koch ba'adam la'asig v'limtzoh amitat taborei. And just as God cannot, just as man cannot begin to fathom the truth of God's existence, as it says, Lo Yirani Adam Bachai, like Moshe, God, Moshe couldn't see God's essence. So too, En Koch Badam Asik Vilim Tzoda Toshel Borei. So too, if man can't know God's essence, man can't know God's knowledge. Because his knowledge is part of God. That's the limit of the human mind. The same way God said to Moshe, you can't know the essence of what I am. God says to him, you can't know what it is to me to know the entire world.
So by definition, there can't be a solution to this problem.
So there can't be a humanly fathomable, comprehensible solution to this problem, says the Rambam.
By definition.
Right.
Because God is infinite and we are finite.
Right. So writes the Rambam.
That's the answer.
No, that's the Rambam's answer. That's the Rambam's answer. I'll show you the Rambam in a second. Kivan sheken hu ein banu koach leda hech yada kadosh baruch hu kol abrim ve'masim. We do not have the ability or the capability to know how it is that God knows our deeds and God knows our actions. Aval neda b'lisafek. But we must realize without doubt shemaaseh ha'adam biyad ha'adam, that man's actions are his own. And God is not forcing us to do A or to do B. This isn't only because we accept it as a masoret, a tradition in our history, but there are philosophical proofs to the fact that man operates under free will, and therefore he can be accountable, and therefore he can have there can be prophecy. And he concludes and says, all of prophecy is built around this notion that God, that man is a man of free will. Otherwise prophecy would make more sense. So what's the answer to the question? Unanswerable, says the Rambam. Because the moment I establish that God's knowledge is part of God's essence, man can't know his essence, he can't understand how God understands. Now, I have just enough time to read you the Ravid. The Ravid says as follows.
The didactic not looking?
Excuse me?
What's it?
Why did I look at Mitch?
Yeah.
I'm very frustrated. I started to have to take my glasses off to read the small print. It's a very frustrating experience for me. Anyway, I had a birthday this week. What can I tell you?
Happy birthday.
After my birthday, it went downhill from there.
You've got to get glasses with those funny lines. And
that's why I looked at Mitch. Yeah,
that's your birthday present.
Says the Raven, Kevan Sheken Hu Ein Banu Koyach. He quotes the Rambam. He quotes that opening line of the Rambam. Man cannot know God's knowledge. Now listen to the Ravid's critique. This is unbelievable. This is the harshest critique the Ravid has against the Rambam in any of his glosses. Not glasses, glosses. Omer Avram, Lo nahag zeh mechaber minhag chachamim. The author here, referring to the Rambam, has not conducted himself in a manner appropriate to the saged wisdom. Why? She'en adam matchil b'davar v'lo yada lahashlimo. Because most people don't start a question without knowing how to answer it. V'hu echel b'shelot kushiyot. He starts with very difficult questions. V'niach adavar b'kushiyah. And he leaves it with a question that's unanswered. And he threw it back to blind faith. We can't understand it, but no, it's true.
טוב היה לו להניח הדבר בתמימות התמימים ולא יעורר ליבם ויניח דעתם בספק.
The Rambam would have been better off not asking the question at all, leaving it to innocence. Better innocent than asking a question that you can't answer.
More than that, אולי שעה אחת יבוא הרחור בליבם על זה.
Maybe somebody will read this Rambam and there will be a moment of doubt in his mind. Maybe it's all a lie. You asked a question which is a really good question, but you didn't answer it. So maybe the question is better than the answer. Maybe the question is true and the answer is wrong. And therefore throw the whole thing out.
So what does the Ravid do?
The Ravid is forced to give an answer to this question. Because what's his whole critique? His critique is you can't ask a question unless you prepared to answer it. I'm sure the Ravid would have been happier had the question not been asked. But now that the question has been asked, he's forced to give an answer. So let's take a look at the Ravid's answer. We'll see if it does us any better than the Rambam's answer.
And even though there's no absolute answer to this question, the Ravid will admit. And therefore you think would have preferred the question not have been asked. Tovu lismoch lo aktzat tshuva.
I'll give you a little bit of an answer, a partial answer.
V'omer, im hayu tzidkat ha'adam v'rishato tluyim b'gzerat ha'borei itbarach.
If, in fact, man's righteousness would be based completely on God's decree,
hayinu omrim sh'yidiyato higzerato.
And we would say that God's knowledge, as I said, the term that I used before was God's knowledge creates reality. The God's knowledge is a gzeira, it's a decree that creates that situation.
And then I tell anu hashayla kasha.
Then we would have a very difficult and really unanswerable question.
Kasha mo. V'achshav shehaborei hesir zu hamimshala miyado.
Now that I know that God has removed this authority from his hand, and has given it over to the hands of man, then God's knowledge is not an absolute decree. It's like the knowledge of the astrologers. Who somehow know from the stargazing what's going to be. That's how God's knowledge of the future is.
And therefore, man has the ability to change that mazal. Talks about the mazal, and man's ability to change his mazal. V'ukoach natun bi'adam liyot tov or ra.
God gave man the ability to be good or bad, and to change, to borrow a term from a movie, change your stars, right? To change your mazal. God knows what the stars tell us. Just what I want to do. I don't know about you, but I'm left cold with the Ravid's answer. I like the Rambam's answer better. No, personal opinion. I have a great deal of difficulty with this Ravid because it's so limited. What he's saying is that God, in a sense, although he took the whole domain of free will and took it out of his hands and gave it to man, and he says, okay, I will not know what's really going to be. I will look into the stars and gaze upon the patterns of history, but ultimately your knowledge will unfold and I will become aware of it. You have the ability to change that, and if you change it, I will become aware of your changes as they happen. But that goes back to the question of time. So for the Rambam, that's certainly an unacceptable answer. So in the end, we don't really have a good answer to this question. But since neither did the Rambam, I think we're in okay company.
But there's something that the way he states it which is the knowledge of God is not comprehensible by that in itself is a problem.
Why is it a problem?
Because basically what he's saying is he doesn't know the answer.
No, he's saying the answer is unknowable. There's a difference.
And what is the difference?
The difference is the difference between the it's like the Heisenberg uncertainty principle.
But because to say that something is unknowable is a form of knowledge.
To say that something's unknowable is different from saying I don't know it. Right? Take for example, the example that I cited from physics was not an accident. Are you familiar with the Heisenberg uncertainty principle? Yes? No? Physics, quantum
physics.
You can't
know a particle's right. position and velocity.
It's a principle of modern physics that states that there are basically two pieces of information that you need to know in order to establish all the information about subatomic particles. One is its spin, and the other is its location. Right? Essentially, if I know its spin and I know its location, then I know where it's going to be at any given time. It's like something moving along the highway. I know where it is here, and I know where it is, how fast it's going. So I know exactly when it'll get to here. So the Heisenberg uncertainty principle says that these two pieces of information together are unknowable. I can measure the spin of a subatomic particle, but then I will lose the information on its location. I can measure its location, but I cannot measure its location and its spin or energy level at the same time. But he didn't say that I don't have enough information to make that determination, or I don't have the right tools to make that determination. What he said is that that information is unknowable. And there's a mathematical and logical reason for it, because I interfere with one of them when I measure the other. So the information is unknowable. There's a difference between something being unknown and unknowable. The Rambam is not saying, I don't know the answer. That would talk would be uncharacteristic of the Rambam. Right? The Rambam is saying, the answer is unknowable. There's a difference. Right? I'm not sure which is particularly more satisfying to us. But there's a difference, and I think that's what the Rambam is arguing. So when I said to you back in principle number four, and I stand by what I said, that if you look at the issue from the perspective of time, that we acquire knowledge in a timeline. So that which we don't know today, we'll know tomorrow. Whereas God exists outside of that timeline, so tomorrow and yesterday is all the same thing. And just as I don't have a problem theologically with the notion of God being aware of what I did yesterday, I don't have a problem with God being aware of what I did tomorrow, because from God's perspective, there is no today, yesterday, and tomorrow. It's all one big picture. Okay. That answer, which we had offered as a possible answer to this question, is really a reformulation of what the Rambam is saying. What he's saying is that our knowledge and God's knowledge operate on completely different planes. Our knowledge is sequential. God's knowledge is part of his essence. Our knowledge is built within a time frame. God's knowledge is outside of the time frame. Well, that's essentially what the Rambam is saying. Only difference is that the conclusion, therefore, is we can't understand that. It's a concept we can't get our heads around. What is life without a timeline? It's like the clock. It's like the heartbeat of the universe. You can imagine what life could exist would be like without that heartbeat. They use the analogy from the medical field. You know, time is to the universe as the heart is to the human being. Figure out what a person would feel like or look like if he didn't have a heart. It's unfathomable.
Tim Woodman.
Maybe.
I have to go find the wizard.
That's right. So,
this is where the Rambam leaves us. It does not leave us with a very clear, definitive answer in this question. But he leaves us with the great ponder, and the truth is, as Rav Soloveitchik was off to say, part of religious life is tension. And he leaves us with a tension between the feeling, the sense, the philosophical position, the axiomatic foundation of Judaism, which is that God is aware of everything I do, and he cares about everything I do, with the broad philosophical, theological concept of what God is, and therefore how could he become aware of anything? It's a tension. It's an unresolved tension. But the analogy of the timeline concept allows me to sleep well at night. I don't know if I've helped, but maybe. Question? No?
Well, you know, attention we can understand, we can relate to. So
you can ask me any question you like except the Rambam's question.
Is that the only question he didn't have an answer to? I'm just curious.
I didn't say he didn't have an answer to.
No.
He had an answer. The answer is that it's unknowable.
Was that the only question he's ever had that had that trump card?
I don't know, but it's certainly the most famous because it's so foundational. Kids ask this question. This is the classic question that kids, third graders, second graders ask this question. And it's if the Rambam couldn't answer it, what are you going to answer a second grader who asks this question? Anybody comes up with an answer to that, let me know. Okay, we were adjourned.